streets hold many secrets. From alleyways in the heart of London to the quietest country lane, they've all witnessed cruelty and violence, jealousy and despair. They've seen crimes of passion and cold-hearted murder. They've seen killers escape, killers brought to justice. In this series, we'll be investigating the most notorious crimes and intriguing mysteries. Stories of men and women who killed, of the police who hunted them, and the victims who were left behind. From the files of Scotland Yard and far beyond, this is the dark history of our streets. In the early 20th century, a new technology changed the way we consume the news forever. No longer would we rely on words or still photography alone. Moving pictures had arrived. The cameras would be there for the grand funeral of Queen Victoria in 1901. They would be there for the flights of the first powered aircraft and for the 1908 Olympic Games. And in 1911, they would be there to record police, soldiers, and Winston Churchill join a gun battle on the streets of London. A battle which would last 6 hours and would see 400 rounds of ammunition fired and would come to be known as the Siege of Sydney Street.
In many ways, the Sydney Street siege was the first breaking news story in history.
The public were enthralled by this story of what had happened.
This is a chance to prove the value of movie news. Something exciting going on, something with real drama. They're not going to miss the opportunity to come and film that.
It was unique. It was the first time anything like this had ever happened.
In the early 20th century, London was still the largest city in the world. The Victorian era had seen thousands move to the capital in search of work. Migrants from overseas had joined them.
Immigrants became easy scapegoats. They were blamed for the poverty, the poor housing, and unemployment rife in the most deprived districts. And then, as now, there were politicians and newspapers eager to stoke discontent. The government felt it had to act. In 1905, it passed the first restrictions on immigration seen in a century. The Aliens Act gave the government powers to turn away immigrants deemed undesirable, the sick, the poor, the elderly.
1905 Aliens Act, which was passed by the Conservative Party, was highly restrictive of immigration, especially Jewish immigration from Eastern Europe and other parts of Central Europe.
There was a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism. This was particularly rife in Whitechapel. Jews were looked on as competitors for housing, as for workplaces.
In many ways, the government is reacting to popular pressure. It's not necessarily deeply concerned itself, but it is deeply concerned that the populace is concerned. So government wants to keep the electorate on side.
But the Act did nothing to relieve the misery of places like the East End. Immigrants remained the target of popular anger. In 1909, a notorious crime seemed to confirm people's worst prejudices. Guns were fired on the streets of London. Innocent people were killed, and two immigrants were responsible. The press dubbed it the Tottenham Outrage.
It all began at a rubber factory on Tottenham High Road. This was the target of two robbers, a pair of young Latvian revolutionaries named Paul Helfelt and Jacob Lepidus.
On Saturday mornings, the chauffeur of the owner of the factory would go off to the bank and come back with the money in order to pay the wages in cash.
It seems that on this particular occasion, the 16th of December, you have an attempt made at a wages robbery, literally as the car is drawing up at the factory.
Jacob Lepidus and Paul Helfelt stopped the car. Immediately, there was resistance from the chauffeur.
They did do the wages snatch, but in doing so, they pulled guns and started firing them at the person carrying the money and at the driver of the vehicle.
Unfortunately for them, the factory gates are directly opposite the local Tottenham police station. The police come running to see what's going on their doorstep, and they set off in hot pursuit.
As they ran, Helfelt and Lepidus fired wild shots at their pursuers. One fatal shot caught a 10-year-old boy in the chest.
On Chingford Road, the two men leapt onto the number 9 tram, its driver and passengers fleeing in terror. Lepidus and Helfelt took the conductor hostage and forced him to drive the tram as the police closed in.
Meanwhile, the police, in hot pursuit, grab a tram going the other way and reverse it. So Lepidus is at back of the tram, firing in the direction of the pursuing police tram on the other side of the road.
It was a tram chase through the streets. So the two anarchists got off the tram and got onto a milk float.
Helfelt and Lepidus set off at such a violent pace that going around a corner, they overturned the milk float, leaving it with milk churns, bottles floating all over the place.
Then they had another horse-drawn van and they whipped the horse to try and get it to go, but of course it had its brake on. It was one of these chains that blocked the wheels.
They drive that, flogging the horse until it sort of drops down from exhaustion. The chase now goes on for somewhere between 2 and 3 hours.
Eventually, Helfelt can't climb over a necessary wall and decides to shoot himself.
Bullet goes behind his eyes and out the other side, and he's still alive when the pursuers catch up with him and take him prisoner.
Lepidus continued his desperate flight alone. Reaching Hale End, he barged into a tiny cottage. The owner's screams soon attracted the attention of the police in pursuit. Lepidus retreated to an upstairs bedroom, but there was nowhere left to run.
Lepidus, at that point, shoots himself rather more effectively in the head, and so they are just left with his dead body.
They never did actually find the wages. The rumour is that the owner of the cottage sort of lived for quite a long time afterwards on the proceeds which had been stuck up the chimney.
There were no cameras in Tottenham that day. No recording of the theft or the chase that followed. But 1 year later, the cameras would be there.
wasn't a noise Max Weil was used to on a Friday night. His shop was in a largely Jewish area, and it was the Sabbath. It was usually quiet. But Friday, the 16th of December 1910, was a Sabbath like no other. When Weil returned to his home above his shop at 120 Houndsditch, he was met by the concerned faces of his sister and their servant. It was after 10 p.m. Above the wind gusting in the chimney, they could hear hammering and banging. It was coming from the jeweler's next door.
The group that attempted the jewel robbery in Houndsditch on the east side of the City of London were a mixed group.
You're talking about handfuls of individuals, not necessarily socialist, anarchist, but simply from the same place, speaking the same language.
Nobody really knew how closely they were connected, other than having come from similar places in sort of Eastern Europe or Russia. And they would have known each other because they'd have been members of the same anarchist club.
Key figures were a man called George Gardstein. He was a general Mr. Fix-It. He brought everyone together. Several others in the group had all been caught up in the 1905 revolution in Latvia. They'd all been imprisoned, they'd all been tortured.
They actually have a public impact far beyond their number.
Other than Gardstein, the identities of the gang members have never been confirmed, but their target was clear enough: the safe at the back of the shop. It was rumoured to contain jewellery worth £20,000, a vast sum in those days.
The attempt on the jewellers was part of the kinds of raids that were then going on across Europe.
The groups are carrying out expropriations. What they did was carry out robberies. So the money was partly to fund political activities, but also as a way of sort of a subsistence for them themselves.
With the inspiration of figures like Stalin and Lenin, various socialists and anarchists were taking the lead in gathering money to send arms, to send ammunition back to Russia, places like St. Petersburg and Moscow, but also, of course, Latvia being one of the most powder keg places in the Russian Empire, back to Latvia.
Early in December 1910, Gardstein and his gang had rented two buildings behind the jewellers on Houndsditch. They brought in specialist cutting tools, diamond-tipped drills, crowbars and chisels. Then, when the jewellers closed that Friday night, the gang put their plan into action. A privy in the yard of their rented buildings backed onto the jewellers. At around 9 o'clock, the gang started breaking through the wall. What they hadn't anticipated was Max Weil. He listened in his kitchen. He listened in his shop. Then he took himself off into the night to find a policeman.
Max Weil's immediate reaction is what sends the whole thing in a totally unexpected direction, because he goes and informs the police.
The neighbours told the police that they thought that the new tenants next door were acting a bit strangely. There was lots of noise going on at night, sounds of hammering as if they were trying to demolish a brick wall or trying to tunnel into somewhere.
I don't think they had ever thought that if they were heard, somebody would go and tell the police. They were used to coming from communities where that was the last thing you did.
At 11 p.m., Constable Walter Piper walked into the small cul-de-sac behind the jeweler's shop. It was called Exchange Buildings. there was a light at number 11. He knocked on the door.
Asked if there were any problems, got not much of a reply, but his suspicions were aroused.
Went back and told the sergeant and other policemen from Bishopsgate Police Station. What he didn't say was that he'd actually been to the house. And so that when the police went to the house, the gunmen were prepared for them.
By 11:30, there were 9 policemen on the scene. They were armed only with regulation wooden truncheons.
That goes back to the inception of the modern uniformed police back in the 1820s, with the setting up of the Metropolitan Police in 1829 by Sir Robert Peel. He was determined that his new police force should not be armed because he said it would not be acceptable to the population.
But nevertheless, the police had been armed on and off in Victorian times. It tended to go in phases. There was a period when police officers were able to wear and carry revolvers if they so wished. Well, if they so wished was also a matter of what their senior officers would actually allow them to do.
They're not expecting a gunfight. They're armed with truncheons, whistles, and their own sense of authority.
Sergeant Robert Bentley now took charge. He stationed Constable Piper on Houndsditch in front of the jewellers, and another constable he left in Cutler Street. The other policemen joined him in Exchange Buildings. Exactly what happened in the next few minutes is still unknown. But we know it was Bentley who knocked on the door of number 11. A tall, dark-haired man opened the door. He gave no answer to the sergeant's inquiries and disappeared back inside. Bentley forced his way through the door. Another policeman named Bryant followed. A doorway just inside led to a small parlour. A fire burned in the grate. The remnants of dinner still sat on the table. The two policemen were about to press on when the door leading out to the yard flew open. A man burst in, holding a Dreiser semi-automatic pistol. He opened fire.
As soon as the door was opened, there was a hail of gunfire.
Bentley was shot twice, fell back dead, dying over the doorstep.
Other members, possibly up to 4 of the gang who are discovered inside, open fire. Sergeant Bryant is shot, wounded but not killed, and he falls.
Outside, Constable Woodhams was waiting opposite the house. He rushed forward, but another bullet shattered his leg and he too collapsed to the ground. The gang stepped over the bleeding policeman and moved out into the street, still firing. Sergeant Charles Tucker was the next to fall, shot through the heart. The remaining police backed away, and the gang's escape route seemed clear. But then, roaring out of the shadows, 34-year-old Constable Walter Choate grabbed one of the fleeing men. Choate was tall and strong and clung desperately onto his prey. But in the struggle, he was shot 3-4 times before he crumpled to the ground.
And as he fell backwards, a shot meant for Choate caught Gardstein in the back.
He was shot by one of his colleagues because they were letting off their guns very rapidly, but not too accurately where they were aiming.
They then disappear, leaving the police to pick up the aftermath.
They left behind a scene of blood and chaos. The wounded police were rushed away. Sergeant Tucker was dead by the time he reached hospital, and nothing could be done for Choate or Bentley. Both would die within hours. By then, the hunt for the fugitives had already begun. On the morning of Saturday, the 17th of December, 1910, Britons woke to news of another outrage on the streets of London. A gang had been foiled in their attempt to rob a jeweler's and shot five policemen in the aftermath. Three would die of their injuries.
And as the news spreads, it is met with outrage in the press. It's not so much the robbery. That isn't what causes the outrage. It's the lack of Britishness, the lack of willingness to accept British ways that causes the outrage. These are foreigners, these are alien actions.
Because it was to do with anarchists, there was a real fear of what was happening. To some extent, it was to do with the fact that they had firearms, but also so much ammunition.
What had happened in Tottenham was a real letdown. The two figures, Hetfield and Lepidus, had died. There is no trial where you can bring these two anarchists, these vile figures, as they are described in the newspapers, to justice. In the case of the Houndsditch murders, where not one but three policemen were killed, it wasn't going to happen again. They were absolutely determined that it was not going to happen again.
Police fanned out across London in search of the fugitives. What they didn't know was that one of the men they were after was already dead. After the foiled burglary, the gang had fled Houndsditch. Their leader, a man calling himself George Gardstein, had been shot during their escape, and his accomplices were forced to carry him a mile to Whitechapel. There they took refuge in a small house on Grove Street. Gardstein was badly hurt, but they dared not take him to hospital. Leaving him in the care of two female associates, the rest of the gang fled.
Two women went to a local doctor and begged him to come and attend this man, saying that he couldn't be moved.
They were absolutely adamant that they weren't going to go to hospital. The doctor did what he reasonably could for him, went back to see him the next day to find that he'd died.
The doctor reported the death to the coroner, who informed the police. At once, detectives hurried to the house in Grove Street. They found the man's corpse on a bed upstairs and one of the women burning evidence. She was arrested and Gardstein's body taken away. Police had no doubt that this was one of the Houndsditch killers. In the man's pockets, they found ammunition, gloves, and a key to number 9 Exchange Buildings. The rooms upstairs in Grove Street had been rented by two men. One was called Fritz Swars. The other one was known only as Peter the Painter. Many of the gang used pseudonyms. Gardstein was also known as Goldstein, as Morawitz, as Milowitz, and as Maradzev. Tracking the movements and contacts of the gang would be no easy task.
A great manhunt started to track down these people who were involved in this anarchist gang.
They launch an operation, the City of London Police with the Metropolitan Police, because they know that the gang has fled out of the city and into the slums and stews of East London and taken refuge there.
They knew who some of them were, but it was a very confusing situation. They had a number of different passports, so it was very complicated to work out who was who.
When the news of the policeman had been killed, there was absolute terror in the East End, because they thought the police would start carrying out pogroms, purges. And this was a big problem.
Almost 100 detectives scoured the East End. But many people living there spoke little or no English, and nobody on the police force could speak the immigrants' languages either. Progress was slow. Police took in almost anyone they could connect to the missing men. A Russian mechanic named Fedorov, a Latvian named Dubov, and Yakov Peters, the cousin of the fugitive Svars. All eventually admitted knowing the wanted men, but all denied involvement in the murders.
The same day police made those arrests, a memorial service was held for their fallen colleagues. Thousands gathered at St. Paul's Cathedral to pay their respects. 38-year-old Sergeant Bentley had been shot on his wedding anniversary. His heavily pregnant wife was at his bedside when he died. She gave birth to a boy 4 days later. Sergeant Tucker was 47 and a father of two. He should have retired from the police that year, but had signed on for an extra 12 months just weeks before his death. Constable Choate was unmarried and lived in the Bishopsgate Street section house. His mother had died just 12 days before the shooting. Choate would be buried alongside her.
Svars, Peter the painter, and possibly others were still on the loose. As Christmas came and went, detectives began to lose hope. Had the men slipped out of London? Had they fled overseas? Would justice ever be done? Then, a tip-off arrived from an unexpected source.
What changed things was when they got a piece of unexpected information from a man called Charles Perelman.
He liked to see himself as a romantic revolutionary. According to his son, he had soft eyes like a deer and a beautifully spoken voice. But he was the man who would betray the two men in Sydney Street.
He's a letter of dodgy lodgings to dodgy individuals. So he comes in, apparently wrapped up in cloak and scarf to disguise that he is going to the police to lay information that he knows two of his former lodgers, Felix Svars and Jacob Sokolov, are actually to be found holed up on the second floor of a tenement building in Sydney Street.
The police moved more carefully this time. Early on the morning of January the 3rd, they sealed off the area around Sydney Street. They evacuated surrounding buildings and cleared the lower floors of number 100. With everything in place, they threw stones against the upper windows to get the fugitives' attention. They were answered by a barrage of gunfire. The siege of Sydney Street had begun.
It was starting to sleet. It fell on the crowds gathered to watch, on the police holding them back, and it drifted through the shattered windows of number 100 Sydney Street. There, two desperate men were preparing their last stand.
Almost certainly, what Svarz and Sokolov have in that lodging in Sydney Street is a substantial consignment of arms and ammunition.
Now, the police were not armed at this stage. They didn't carry weapons, and so somebody was sent to get weapons. Then they came back with a load of shotguns with a maximum range of not more than 30 yards.
With the house empty, Svarz and Sokolov ranged from floor to floor, window to window, firing whenever a policeman showed himself. The police were outgunned, and the building's narrow, steep stairs made a direct assault suicidal. It was a standoff.
They kept expecting them to run out of ammunition, and they don't. And they have a marksmanship, a firepower that is completely beyond what the police expect.
The only way of hitting the two gunmen was by firing directly across the street. Shots down the street would have gone nowhere.
The police realised that although they had some firearms, they didn't have the firearms that could cope with this kind of situation.
The police decided they needed help. The 1st Battalion Scots Guards were stationed just a mile away at the Tower of London, and a request for a detachment of marksmen was sent. At 10:15, 19 soldiers marched into Sydney Street, each armed with a new Lee Enfield rifle. The men took up positions in the streets and houses surrounding the besieged building.
Considering what had happened at Houndsditch, there was no problem whatsoever with regard to the state using its monopoly of violence against this terrorist organisation.
They took up various positions from vantage points that overlooked the front and the back of the house, and whenever there was any movement, there was a volley of shots from the soldiers.
To import the army into this situation, this is something that's not likely done, because apart from anything else, you've also got to involve the War Office.
Winston Churchill was in the bath when news of the siege reached him. The future Prime Minister was 36 years old, the second youngest Home Secretary in history. He quickly dressed and made his way to the scene.
Winston Churchill had only been Home Secretary for less than a year at the time of the Sydney Street siege.
He then decided that he would go down to Sydney Street and see what was happening. He would go and see the fun. He then found himself in the unenviable position of being the senior man in charge.
Had he stopped and thought about it for 2 minutes, would have realised that it was not appropriate for a Home Secretary in a top hat and a big overcoat with an Astrakhan collar to be peering around walls looking at the house in question. But nonetheless, that wasn't Winston Churchill at all. He was very much a man who was driven by his emotions, driven by his passions, and one of them was to be at the scene.
He started to say, well, you know, that the police officers ought to move back or forwards or take up various positions. You would say that he probably relished this opportunity to get out of his stuffy office and all the files and correspondence he might have had to deal with and deal with a real situation.
By the time that Churchill has turned up, you've got a huge crowd gathered.
The crowds were enormous. If you look at the newsreel, you can see the surrounding streets, they're on the pub roof. They're all over the place.
With army marksmen on the scene, Svarz and Sokolov could no longer move through the building at will. They were pinned down. The siege threatened to drag on for another day, until fortune intervened.
At 12:50, smoke was seen rising from the house. It was soon creeping out through the windows of the upper floors, growing darker and thicker.
Nobody knows how the fire started. Still to this day, we have no idea how it began.
It seems to me that it's likely to have been either set deliberately by the occupants, by Svaz and Sokolov, seeing no way out, or alternatively, to have happened accidentally, because the level of firepower that they were employing, the kind of slum tenement where there will have been all kinds of debris which could easily catch fire.
The fire gradually took hold. Winston Churchill said to the fire brigade, stay back, don't go into danger to put the fire out.
He made it clear that he didn't believe that the fire brigade should go in because he said that he didn't want any British lives put at risk.
He insists that unless the flames spread to the neighbouring building, then there shall be no intervention.
The houses had been built with asbestos brick, so the fire didn't spread to the houses on either side. It just burned down between the two main walls.
As flames consumed the house, police, soldiers, and onlookers like Winston Churchill waited for the fugitives to emerge. They never did. The siege of Sydney Street had ended. Police and firemen searched the smouldering house. It was collapsing around them, but finally, they found the charred remains of the two fugitives. One had died of a gunshot wound to the head. The other had been overcome by smoke and flames. Churchill's presence at the siege did not go unnoticed. Many questioned whether it was proper conduct for a Home Secretary. His political enemies were quick to exploit the controversy.
The general wisdom is that Home Secretaries shouldn't get involved in operational police matters. But Winston Churchill was Winston Churchill.
Churchill was always immensely hands-on his whole career. You see this again and again, that he didn't feel that he was able to comment on something unless he was physically present there.
A politician of greater sense would have not gone near it. But Churchill was 36, so still a young man. He himself had been both a soldier and a war correspondent. For him, this was more excitement than he'd come across in a long time. And I think it was purely irresistible.
And years later, in one of his writings about himself, he admitted that it probably would have been better had he not gone.
He realised he'd made a mistake. In Parliament, one member said, I know why the police were there, but we don't know why the Home Secretary was there.
Churchill shrugged off these accusations. He argued, quite understandably, that he needed to be where the action was, but he slightly half-hearted about this. He preferred the whole story to go away as soon as possible.
The case was not over yet. Svaz and Sokolov had paid the ultimate penalty, as had George Gartstein. But the fates of the others arrested were still to be determined. Police wanted them tried for murder, but the case wasn't strong enough. The charges against Fedorov were dismissed before trial. Dubov and Peters were then cleared by a jury at the Old Bailey. Only Gardstein's lover, Nina Vasilova, was convicted on the count of accessory after the fact. But even that conviction was overturned on appeal.
The judge who presided over the trial was 75-year-old Mr. Justice Grantham, who had an unfortunate reputation. Most of his judgments were overturned on appeal, and this case was going to be no exception.
It was a shambles. I don't think there is any other word that you can use for it.
And the first thing that Mr. Justice Grantham said was, forget the murder charge. The people who actually did the killing of the policeman were Gardstein, who'd been fatally wounded in an exchange building, Joseph and Fritz, who died in Sydney Street. Forget the murder charge against the rest. Out.
The evidence was complicated because nobody could really prove who had fired what shots and who was involved and who wasn't, and whether the two who died at Sydney Street were the real offenders or not.
While there is a moral conviction that these were anarchists who deserved either lifetime imprisonment or execution, there was absolutely nothing substantive on which they could be convicted.
Apparently the prisoners were just looking at one another in great astonishment at what was actually happening. Nobody was ever convicted of the Houndsditch murders.
Others wanted by police escaped entirely. Peter the Painter was never seen again. Some speculated he was a Russian government spy, an agent provocateur. Even today, there is dispute over who was there that night in Houndsditch and what each conspirator's role was.
The Houndsditch murders and the siege at Sydney Street ignited a now familiar debate. Should British police be armed? Although there was no appetite for guns to be issued to all officers, something had to change.
Within weeks, new guns were being tested for police use. In that August, the Metropolitan Police ordered 1,000 Webley and Scott automatic pistols. They had to adapt to the capabilities of new technology. It was new technology that took this story to the masses. Just hours after the end of the siege, the first cinema audiences were watching moving pictures of the drama. The news would never be the same again. Thank you.